I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Health Policy and Public Affairs to order. Welcome, everybody. just to let the staff know, staff as well as members, we are going to have a full mental health calendar next week. Shannon was getting a little worried. So we're going to start next Wednesday's meeting at 7:15. Okay. We'll still start at 8:30 Monday, the mental health, but we will carry those that we can't finish on Monday, they're all mental health bills, into Wednesday's mental health day. So we're going to try to cover as many, because we have, 10 bills that day, the combination?
Something like that.
So, do you have meetings?
Mm.
Okay.
I just came for one.
Right. So,
Legislative Reform Committee.
You may not hear the public testimony on a lot of them, and we will wait for you to work session them. How about you, Senator Carter?
I'm fine.
Yeah. Okay. So, for the world out there, if there are mental health bills that you're going to be testifying on, be prepared to be here at 7:15 a week from today, April 11th. With that, I'd like to open a public hearing on 646. And, colleagues, we have heard this bill as an informational session on when we were at Mount Hood Community College. And so I would like to invite the City of Gresham up, and we are trying to get the people here. And if someone could get Representative Lim, I know he wanted it. Is he? Okay. We'll let Representative Lim start us off.
Well, Madam Chair, one of our speakers today is in the restroom.
Okay. I think we'll start with Representative Lim to sort of kick this off. He and I are co-sponsoring this bill, and we would like to move it today and get it into Ways and Means.
Okay. Thank you.
And we have heard this already when we were in Mount Hood Community College, so if you can just be brief and not take more total time of 10 minutes, that would be very appreciative. Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, Maurice Anderson, and members of the committee, and thank you very much for hearing this Senate Bill 646. As already Chair mentioned, I am one of the co-sponsors. For the record, my name is John Lim, State Representative from District 50, which is Gresham area. And Gresham, I'd like to read from my text I have prepared. Gresham is Oregon's number fourth largest city and the East Metro region. The East Metro region is significantly underserved by cultural venue and program. And this center would serve close to 1.5 million Oregonians, which is about more than 40% of the Oregon residents living in East McCullough, Clackamas County, Hood River County, and also including Clark County in Washington State. And I believe Gresham is nicely located in the center of Oregon. If you look at the east side, we see the beautiful, majestic Mount Hood. If you see the north side, we have the Columbia River, mighty Columbia River runs through the north end, the east and the west. And then beyond that, we have St. Helen, beautiful mountain there. If you look at the west side, there's a beautiful Portland city. And Gresham is located in the center among all of those amenities. Also, In Gresham, we have I-84, 205, 212, and in terms of transportation, it's located in the center area. Our center will serve more than 15,000 children from K through 12, and then 6,000 seniors per year. Our center is an excellent opportunity for economic development for our state, as people coming to watch the performance. Will visit the total. Will visit local restaurants, stores, and gift shops. Vendors will benefit. In other words, jobs will be created. That's why I urge your support, SB 646. Total project, I understand, needs about $4.5 million. City of Gresham has committed $3 million. Last session, legislature appropriated $100,000 as a seed money. I worked with Senator Anderson for this amount, and which was appropriate. I also personally pledged $3,000 toward the Center of Art. $3,000 is a 2 months' pay of my as a legislator. So to me, it's a lot of money, but I
is that a challenge?
I hope I can challenge everyone. And so I already donated $1,000 out of 3,000 pledge, and I will be paying about $1,000 every year until I fulfill my obligation. So, and also I want to know that the Gresham is the city Korean resident first settled in Oregon from Hawaii. So I'm very proud. I'm rooted in the Gresham area. And also Gresham is a multi-culture and racial places. You find every the ethnicity, including Koreans and Japanese, Hispanics, and Afro-Americans, and plus many others. This is the home we all call is a great place to live. All right, and so in other words, East Multnomah County, Gresham, is a small melting pot in the United States. With that, I will be closing my testimony.
Thank you very much. Who goes next?
Okay. Is this on or not?
And pull it in front of you.
Yes.
It is on?
It's on.
Madam Chair and honorable members of the committee, my name is Janet Mauser. I'm a citizen, lived in the Gresham area, taught there for 30 years, and have become a board member for the Gresham Center for the Arts, which is a passion of mine. And so I come today in that capacity. I'm sure that you all remember the film, The Field of Dreams. It was a man, because of his passion for baseball, took a plot of country soil and worked it and worked it until he built a baseball field with lights and bleachers and dugouts and a proper mound for the pitcher. Some folks called him crazy. After all, there was a cornfield not far from center field. But this man and his passion kept saying, if you build it, they will come. I can't help but relate the city of Gresham and its quest for the Center for the Arts to that story. Gresham, a town where 30 years ago farmers and citizens like myself used to come to the big county fair right in the middle of town to look at livestock and to buy cotton candy, and with their children listen to the Mills Brothers sing an evening concert in the shadow of our great Mount Hood. But time has passed, and Gresham has grown into the fourth largest city in our state. This growth happened so quickly that citizens such as myself and my neighbors realize that we have grown far beyond the county fair and a once-a-year concert by visiting celebrities. We have a jazz festival, the Columbia Symphony Orchestra, the Mount Hood Repertory Theater Company. We have local artists and singers and dancers. We have families and underfunded schools that want their children to have cultural and artistic experiences. We have new development. Unfortunately, we have no place, no center for our citizens, no field of dreams, if you will. We need a place that will complement and encourage the economic growth of Gresham and help preserve its historic downtown so dear to us all, a heart for our city. To our great fortune, we were given a plot of land in our downtown area that was once a parking and maintenance spot for our school buses. So our city, with the help of state funding and environmental grants, cleaned up that field and marked it for a center for the arts for the citizens of Gresham. Citizens formed a not-for-profit Center for the Arts board to support the efforts of the city. Citizens pledged money and many hours of volunteer help. We planted grass on our field and put up a big sign, Future Center for the Arts. With the help of state funding and support by wonderful advocates like Senator Mona Sanderson and Representative Lynn, we have been able to hire advisors and architects to help us in our quest. We have drawings of our dream. Developers are planning their ideas around our field. Local artists are creating sculptures. Soon, our first phase plaza will break ground. This summer, a symphony will play on our field, and children will recite poems and create art that has been inspired by their music. The Mount Hood Jazz Festival will entertain on our field. But summer passes quickly, and as we live in Oregon, the rains will fall. Help us continue to build a permanent arts home for our community, a year-round space that will nurture our citizens, encourage positive economic growth, and help preserve our historic city. We can't stop now. The fairgrounds are gone, no longer the center of the city. We need a new gathering place, one that will move Gresham forward into the new century. With your approval of funding, your care for what a city of our size can become, this dream can come true, bringing pride to our city and visitors to our steps. Help us realize our field of dreams, our center for the arts. When it's finished, you will come, and I'll celebrate by waving some cotton candy. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mauser. Mr. Horner.
My name is Jack Horner, and the association with the nursery rhyme is why I have to explain why I'm here. I'm a former president of the Gresham City Council and now a retired citizen, hence the white hair. I only know one actor that has not had to work during his career in another vocation. His name is Tobias Anderson, and he is the artistic director of the Gresham Repertory Theater. He supplements his theater with voiceover and commercial and documentary work. Most actors have to work in a variety of vocations to sustain their passion and use their talent in their primary work. Typically, they work in restaurants, service industry jobs, and a variety of other vocations. They usually have a passion for their work that sustains them, but few work full-time as actors. This is typical of the arts in general, and it is a given in the finances of arts facilities. They all require public help. That's why we're here. Where would we be without art? Art gives soul to a community. How many young, gang-susceptible youth might be turned around by watching Lawrence Fishburne in Othello or Ballet Folklorico from Mexico? Who might be inspired by seeing a production of Garcia Lorca's Blood Wedding or hearing a reading of Marcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude or seeing Tobias in his own production of Darrow or seeing a film noir production, for those of us who remember him, by Robert Mitchum? These are the things that we're trying to bring to Gresham, to all of our citizens in one place, a place that is affordable and accessible to all. I've worked on this project for more than 6 years, and we are on the verge of actually turning a spade in the earth and getting it started. It is a worthy project. It is a necessary project, and it is a viable and potentially powerful economic engine for Gresham's historic downtown. I know that because I live in downtown. In my part of downtown, just two blocks off Main Street, the valuation of the average townhome or condominium, of which there are fewer than 60, is between $200,000 and $300,000. But just one block away, and exceeding to the limits of a planned redevelopment area in downtown, most of the property will qualify for urban renewal. Why is that? It is because we've had to rely on individual entrepreneurship, the market, and fate. You have the opportunity with this bill to change that. You have the opportunity to add marginal value and a substantial multiplier effect by helping us build the Center for the Arts closer to downtown, in fact, in downtown. We expect to break ground this fall with a plaza to be followed by a multi-purpose building and finally a full proscenium theater. But the course will be a long one. Even with the city's contribution of land and system development charges to build the first phase, we face probably 10 years to complete the center. We might be able to do it in 5. We expect that there will be a multiplier effect of 10 to 1 for every dollar we spend in those 10 years, within the first 10 years following completion. This includes the incentive for development in historic downtown, job creation, housing, and the demand for services. But we need your help to make it happen. That's $170 million added to our economy once the center is built. For the $1 million we're asking of you, that is a phenomenal return on investment and a major boost to Oregon's fourth largest city. The project total cost is approximately $17 million, and I don't have to tell you how difficult it is to raise that from private sources. With everyone in the world asking donors to help, most of the big donors are tapped out. The city has already demonstrated its willingness to pitch in, and will, I am sure, ask the citizens to pitch in with bonded debt when the time comes. But now we need your help. We need the state's seed money to start the ball rolling, and it is a small price to pay for the economic and cultural return that we expect. We're asking you to give us the boost we need to really initiate this project. We've done everything we can to date, and we have appreciated past state support, but now it is time to really step up to the plate. It is your turn to help us finish this vital project. We want your help culturally, we want it economically, and we want it for the sake of art. As the fourth largest city in the state, we believe we are worth it. Our citizens, particularly our young people, are worth it. And I can recommend no better way to foster economic development than to make this investment in the arts in the city of Gresham. Thank you.
Thank you. And if we could have the final speaker, and then if there are any questions, we'll...
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Kirk Mauser. I'm the artistic consultant for the Center for the Arts and also work with the City of Gresham in community economic development. Just to let you know how your dollars to date have helped us advance this particular project before you, and I think we've also photocopied this as well. Hopefully you all have copies of it. It's a plaza design that we've been working on. It's a combination of 7 years of hard work with a local landscape architect, Greenworks. And what you see here will be our phase one of the Center for the Arts. And it's kind of a rippling effect, if you would, surrounded by four art pillars, which represent literature, fine arts, performance, and music. These ripples will then ripple out into the community at large, the effects of these arts and this community gathering place, along with an interactive fountain for kids so that parents can bring their children during the summer months and sit around the edges, listen to music, and attend galleries and festivals of the sort. This is our first phase. We're hoping to break ground, as Jack Horner had mentioned, immediately following the Mount Hood Jazz Festival, which would be in August. And the funds that the state and also city have provided have given us that opportunity to at least advance this particular project. A lot of the enhancements of artwork, the pillars, the fountain, and other possibilities, we are looking for private donations with the Center for the Arts Foundation, kind of giving them a boost to their capital campaign to raise funds for Phase 2, which is currently listed as the Event Center, but it's really a multi-purpose facility for community gatherings, which includes a small theater of 275 seats and a banquet facility ballroom, which will be ideal for our Columbia Symphony Orchestra events. And then further down the line, we've got the Proscenium Theater, which is your traditional theater, which would seat 700 plus. And we see, as Gresham continues to grow, that that need will be essential about 10 years out from now. And so our hope is to generate the response from the community at large so that we can then realize a traditional proscenium theater further along. But that's where we are right now, and I certainly appreciate Senator Montes Anderson's help and Representative Lim for being here today and allowing us to speak.
Thank you. Are there any questions? All right. Of course, I grew up in Gresham, and the changes that have happened, I appreciate the testimony of everyone. It is an economic development issue for us. I truly feel that it's extremely important. And with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 646 and open a work session on Senate Bill 646.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 646 to the full Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley has moved SB 646 to to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I would just like to say to Mr. Horner how much I enjoyed his testimony, all of the testimony, but particularly the way that he related opportunities for young people through the arts. That really strikes a chord with me, and I appreciated that you put that forward.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just want to make sure I understand what we're doing here. Basically, what we're saying is rather than have Gresham compete with all the other communities on an equal basis, we're just going to fund them directly. Is that it?
That's what's happened in the past. But they are also being a part of the they have submitted grants, four grants, and if you want to come and respond to that question, we and have been successful in some and not successful in others.
That is correct, Madam Chair and Senator Cruz. The not-for-profit arm of the Center for the Arts is the Center for the Arts Foundation, and this is a group of local citizens there that have come together, business leaders, retired school teachers, you name it, that have come together to raise these funds. We've had conversations with Regional Arts Culture Council to develop funding for public artwork. We had the Oregon Cultural Trust come and speak to our board at large to see the opportunities there that exist for future grants. Likewise with the Oregon Arts Commission, actively involved in the grant pursuit of grants. The foundation itself is fairly young and was an offshoot of the city of Gresham, and we're just a little over a year old, having just established our not-for-profit status. And so some of the opportunities are still in waiting within a 2 to 3 year period of time, but we are pursuing as many opportunities that we can possibly find and foresee. So,
and committee, I think it's important for you to realize Gresham is in the conservative part of Multnomah County, and we have the disadvantage of having an extremely low tax base. So every time we, for instance, our community college, which was built in the 60s, we have never been able to pass a bond. It's very difficult. Yet people want the services, and we know that this will actually contribute to the growth and to the state, for that matter, regarding economic development. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I could take you to my counties if you want to see extremely low tax base, because we are so far below you that I'm not even sure we can see you from there. But I mean, that's the reality. And I guess, Madam Chair, does this mean that in the future, if I want something in my county, I should just pass a bill rather than have them go through the competitive process everybody
else
does?
Absolutely, sir.
Okay. We have to look at all ways of helping our own individual communities, and that's what I like about the democratic process. All right.
And the process in Ways and Means has its own competitive.
That's right. That's true.
Structure.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Moved previous question.
All right. Been moved the previous question. Any discussion? All right. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator Cruz?
No.
Senator Gourley?
Aye.
Chair Monas Henderson?
Aye. Motion passed. Thank you, committee, very much. No carrier because it goes away from me. So I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 646 and open a public hearing on SB 8. And Shannon, would you like to read the explanation?
Senate Bill 8 requires a health benefit plan that covers chemotherapy to cover orally administered agents as part of the medical benefit.
All right, and we have Heather Kirk, John Powell. And Senator Courtney, my goodness. Okay. All right, Senator Courtney.
Thank you, Chairman Senator, Vice Chair Gourley, and Senator Carter, and Senator Cruz, members, all members of the Senate Committee on Health Policy and Public Affairs. My name is Peter Courtney. I'm a state senator. I represent District 11, which includes Woodburn, Jervis, and portions of Salem. I live at 2925 Island View Drive North in Salem, 97303. I come here today in support of Senate Bill 8, which I introduced on behalf of Heather Kirk, who sits to my immediate right here. I'm pleased to have her and representatives from the American Cancer Society join us today to discuss this important effort. And John Powell is also at the table. Heather and I met a couple of months ago, and she told me about the story of her father's ordeal. I'll let her discuss the stress and the disappointment faced by her family. She came to me with a proposal that has become Senate Bill 8. Senate Bill 8 and the amendments before you today, and I believe there's two amendments, Senate Bill 1 and 2, and I'm not conversant with all those amendments, but I noticed in my package there are at least two amendments. For the discussion and those close consultation with health insurance providers as well as the American Cancer Society. Senate Bill 8 simply requires health benefit plans that cover chemotherapy to make sure they cover oral ingested agents as part of their medical benefit. I believe that this is a necessary change that helps take Oregon's medical care into the 21st century. So I have more in my written statement, but I'm not going to read from it. Basically, what's going on here is most of the time when you take chemo, it's done intravenously. A needle is put into your arm, whatever, and then there's a drip. In the case of Heather's father, there is a pill that has the very powerful agent that can come into his body through taking a pill. And I'll just tell you, I'm not going to go into much detail personally, but I can just tell you that if one is had to go through chemo, and which usually involves a series of days, and the needle is injected in the arm and the drip, and they have to finally diagnose your strongest veins. But even though you might think you get used to it, you never get used to it. There is a trauma involved that I don't want to describe. And so to be able to take a pill, I cannot begin to tell you how much more soothing, even though you're dealing with a very powerful disease and a very powerful agent you're putting into your body to try to control that disease. A needle put into your arm day after day after day can do a lot of damage to you from an emotional standpoint. So this is a very simple bill. It's as simple as that. I had no idea that chemo could come into your body by pill. I wish it existed a few years ago. And so her father's in this situation. And so she asked me if I would help her with this. And so that leads us to Senate Bill 8. It's a very simple bill. I also have I didn't know I even asked for this. My good L.A. James, I have a legal opinion from legislative counsel. And I just read briefly from it. I just found it on my desk. I guess I did ask for this. Sometimes I ask for things I don't know that I asked for.
Amen.
Yeah, it's true. You requested an opinion on whether Senate Bill 8 includes a health insurance mandate that requires reports on the social and financial effects of the measure under ORS 171.875. I'm going to read the paragraph, but the last sentence in the powerful paragraph says, therefore, it is our opinion that Senate Bill does not require the report required by ORS 171.875. Now I'll let you decide whether or not there's a mandate involved in this. I'll let the insurance industry's representatives as well as certain state senators talk about that. I think it's a close call. So I'm trying to be upfront what we're trying to do here. I think it's a good piece of legislation. We do have an LC opinion. I really appreciate you allowing me to come here today, Chairman Morris Anderson and members of my Health Policy Committee. And to testify with that, I'd like to turn it over, if you would, please. I mean, I'll stay here for questions. Turn it over to the person who came to me those many weeks ago, months ago, Heather Kirk, who sits here to my right.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I apologize, I'm really nervous.
I told her she had to relax.
And
that this is the choir, a good committee.
I believe that. Thank you. My name is Heather Kirk, and I live in St. Paul, Oregon. I'm the only child of Chuck and Marley Stauffer, who are hop and filbert farmers in Hubbard, Oregon. In December of 2005, 3 days after my son's second birthday and the morning after my mom's 57th birthday, try not to get emotional. My dad was diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor. Excuse me. Sorry.
It's okay.
I practiced a lot.
You take your time.
There are no words for the feelings that overwhelmed us and for the fear of this uncharted territory that my strong, healthy, hardworking, and incredibly kind father now faced. 9 days before Christmas, my dad underwent brain surgery where they removed the bulk of the tumor. After what seemed like forever, we received the final pathology on his cancer and developed a plan of attack with his team of doctors. Several weeks after surgery, he was to begin chemotherapy and radiation treatment simultaneously for 42 days. At this emotionally and physically draining time, we were shocked to discover that my dad's form of chemotherapy was not covered by his insurance policy in the same fashion as other forms. My dad was prescribed oral chemotherapy, a pill form, which he can take at home. It is generally much more well-tolerated than intravenous or injectable forms. We were thrilled that he would not have to go in for IV treatments, may not lose his hair, and could sleep through the brunt of the chemo's effects as it's administered before bedtime. However, we were alarmed to learn that he was responsible for over $5,500 for his first round of chemo after already meeting his out-of-pocket requirements. We quickly learned that this discrepancy occurred because orally administered chemotherapy was covered by his Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield individual health plan as a prescription benefit. He had a 50% copay prescription benefit. $5,500 was his 50% copay for his first round of chemo. This treatment was recommended for a minimum of 2 years, possibly indefinitely. Ironically, in order for my dad to try and preserve his life, he was going to have to use his life savings. We immediately began the appeals process with Regents. We asked that they move coverage of his chemotherapy to the major medical benefit of the plan, the same portion that covers all other forms of chemo. It would then be applied toward his deductible, which had already been met, and covered 100%. If he were to receive IV or injectable chemotherapy, it would have been paid for. I've included a chart that demonstrates his out-of-pocket cost difference between receiving oral chemotherapy and traditional forms. If the effectiveness were equal, my dad would have chosen to undergo the more grueling IV route instead of the pills, just so it would have been covered. Thankfully, because of medical advancements, the gold standard treatment for brain tumors and many other cancers has become a pill. It only seems fair that all forms of chemotherapy receive the same coverage. Regents denied our appeal. In the year that has passed, my dad has had to take chemo for 5 days of each month, paying $1,715 every 23 days. This is apart from his portion of all the costly prescriptions to treat inflammation, nausea, fatigue, seizures, and more. After a year of getting used to all the changes in our family incurred by this brain tumor, I finally have the time and energy to tackle this insurance problem. I sought assistance from my best friend, who has a legislative background, and with her help, along with Senator Courtney's and many others, I find myself here in support of Senate Bill 8. I'm no expert by any means, but I have personally done a lot of research based on the information that my dad's neuro-oncologist suggested. I have evidence that oral chemotherapy is much less costly than IV or injectable forms. The orally administered form is becoming more and more prevalent for many types of cancers, including breast cancer and colon cancer. It's often more effective and less toxic, and is preferred by patients when the expected outcome is equal to that of other forms. This information is detailed in the last page of my written testimony. We have assembled a work group on this bill and invited members of the insurance and cancer society lobbies to ensure that the bill is in the best interest of everyone involved. Having no experience in this arena, the original bill was my best effort at creating a solution to establish equality for all forms of chemotherapy treatment. Since then, our work group has drafted language that better represents my intentions and is included in the Dash 3 amendment. In addition, John Powell made Regents aware of my dad's situation, and they addressed it internally. I want to formally express our gratitude. Not only have they begun to cover his chemo equal to the other forms, but they retroactively reimbursed him from the beginning of treatment to present. Just over a week ago, he received a check for thousands of dollars in the mail.
You're not supposed to make the panel cry.
And that he can now put back into his retirement or toward future health care costs. Obviously, we're surprised and overjoyed that my dad's situation has been resolved. It's my understanding that Regents also rectified patient situations similar to my dad's. Within Regents, this problem appears to be isolated to their individual plans. Unfortunately, upon initial research of other insurance providers, these oral chemotherapies are sometimes not covered, limited in quantity, or require high copays on their group plans as well. The Dash 3 amendment, which I support, extends fairness to all insurance policies. However, the Dash 2 amendment limits this coverage to individual policies only. My intent here has never been to rectify the situation solely for my dad, although the relief we've experienced from its recent resolution is tremendous. My goal is to make any recommended chemotherapy treatment accessible to any insured patient who needs it. I urge you, when you review the proposed amendments, to ensure this protection for all cancer patients on individual and group plans. When most people are hit with cancer diagnosis and treatment, the last thing they have energy to do is fight the system. Orally administered chemotherapy should be treated by health insurance companies equal to all other forms of chemotherapy. My objective is to turn this devastating family illness into an opportunity that brings fairness, help, and ultimately hope to others. Thank you very much for your time and your consideration. I very much appreciate the opportunity to share our story with you.
Thank you very much, Heather.
Thank you.
And how is your father?
He's doing very well, thank you.
Thank you.
Good. Well. Good.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we support the Dash 3 amendments.
Okay. Are there questions for the panel? All right.
Thank you, Chair.
With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 8 and open a work session on Senate Bill 8.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1. Just the Dash 3? The Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 8.
Senator Burley moves the Dash 3s to Senate Bill 8. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Let's have the clerk call the roll.
Senator Carter.
Yes.
Senator Courtney.
Yes.
Senator Cruz.
Yes.
Senator Gorman.
Aye.
Chairman Sanderson.
Aye. And motion passes, and I would like to ask Senator Courtney, would you be willing to...
All you've done is adopt the amendment.
Oh, we just adopted the amendment. I got so excited. All right. Senator Gorley moved the Dash 3s to Senate Bill 8. Is there any discussion, any opposition? Okay, so ordered. Now.
I move the Senate Bill 8 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Gorley moves Senate Bill 8 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator
Gorley? Aye.
Chairman Sanderson?
Aye. Motion passes, and Senator Courtney will carry the bill, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 8.
Thank you
very much. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 988.
Shannon? Can you require all of us to
stop crying before.
I know.
Senate Bill 988 prohibits hospitals from charging uninsured or underinsured patients for hospital services at rates exceeding Medicare payment rates.
All right, and do I have the sign-up sheet? I don't have a sign-up sheet. All right, Mr. Earls, Mr. Caden, and Ms. Lewis.
This is when we do our finest work.
Who wants to start?
Oh. Mr. Earls, we'll be starting.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kevin Earls, Vice President of Finance and Public Policy for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I'm joined at the podium today by representatives from Providence Health Systems, and we thought we would combine our testimony in the interest of time and economy. We are pleased to have the opportunity to present some discussions about opposition to Senate Bill 988 as it's currently drafted. I think we recognize that there is an intent behind the draft that emanates from some national coverage about charges to the uninsured, and we'd like to spend a few minutes of your time walking through what's happening here in Oregon, and then the representatives from Providence will provide additional testimony and give you some perspective kind of from the ground level of a health plan trying to meet the needs of uninsured Oregonians. I'd like to start my testimony with a short story which illustrates the issue at hand. In the late 1880s, the town fathers of a city located in a mountainous region of Brazil set out to build a municipal railroad to improve access to their community. The ensuing project required the construction of many tunnels and bridges because of the rugged terrain in which the town was located. And as a result, costs overran the original projections. And when the railway was completed, city fathers were forced to set fares for the railway at rates that were higher than originally anticipated, which resulted in a reduction of the number of riders on the railroad. And as that happened, a further increase was necessary in order to meet the revenue projections that were necessary, which caused a further drop in ridership. This precipitated the inevitable closure of the railroad when city fathers could no longer service the debt associated with the project's construction. I share this story today because hospitals are faced with much of the same challenges. How to find the right balance between the need to maintain paying customers and to maintain financially viable financial assistance programs for those in need in the communities in which they serve. Here's where the challenge comes in for hospitals. We have, in effect, three payers at the end of the day. We have Medicare with rates set by the federal government, Medicaid with rates set by state government, and the commercially insured population. In those three payers, two of them set their own rates, and they set them well below our actual cost of service. So that creates a hydraulic effect in which we're forced to raise rates for those with commercial insurance. And I'm going to present just a brief slide or two demonstrating the effect that that's had in Oregon in recent years as we've seen the reduction in funding for the Oregon Medicaid program. As payments decline from Medicaid and Medicare, it results in an increase in the prices that we're... forced to increase prices charged to the public, and that involves both public employers, private employers, and their employees and families. So what have hospitals done to help those in need? First, beginning in 1989, Oregon hospitals in the Portland area, working with Oregon Health Action Campaign and other consumer groups, developed the first template for Oregon Hospital Financial Assistance Guidelines. These guidelines were intended to set a framework for hospitals to establish financial assistance policies to meet the needs of their communities. Subsequently, that financial assistance policy was adopted by all hospitals in the state of Oregon. We now provide and have for many years uniform and public access to these policies. In the 2005 legislative session before Senator Montes Anderson's committee, we rolled out a product, a public information product called Oregon Price Point, which presented price information on every medical procedure performed by every Oregon hospital. And as part of Price Point, we did something that no other state in the country has done to this date. We created a link to the financial assistance policy of every hospital in the state and made it publicly available on the web where anyone could access it. We continue to try and balance the circumstances, the financial circumstances of individual hospitals with the financial needs of the community and the need of the hospital to remain financially viable. But we also attempt to try and differentiate between the truly needy and those with the resources to purchase insurance and have elected not to be covered. And I have some data for the committee on that from the Office of Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research. What else are Oregon hospitals doing in addition to having financial assistance policies? Well, we've organized and funded a statewide pool to pay the premiums for OHP standard enrollees who were threatened with the loss of their coverage because they didn't pay the state mandated premiums. We also stepped in to fund the Oregon Health Plan Standard Program when all state funding was withdrawn in the 2003-05 biennium. We picked up the 60,000 Oregonians who were eliminated from coverage in the Oregon Medicaid program when OHP standard was reduced to the shell of its prior existence. And the OHP standard program was virtually eliminated. And every day we provide primary care access to many on Medicaid through our emergency room because the state rates for physician payment are so low that physicians won't participate in the Oregon Health Plan. Well, those are the things that we're doing now, and I want to show you some contextual slides in a moment. We may have to resolve a technical difficulty. But let me briefly address what this bill would do in its current form. Now, we've talked about the kind of the parable of three payers, two that pay less than cost, and the third that has to make up those shortfalls. What the bill would do is immediately move 660,000 uninsured Oregonians into the group that pays less than cost, placing further pressure on the people that have commercial insurance, the employers and employees and their families. It would do the same for an as-yet undetermined number of quote-unquote underinsured individuals that are identified in the bill. These actions together will produce a direct and significant and immediate impact on the cost that commercial purchasers of health insurance will pay. These are Oregonians with private insurance, including that is purchased as an employee benefit plan by state and local governments. It's going to create numerous technical problems. One is a challenge associated with Medicare billing at the procedure level, which is anticipated in the bill. A second is the ability of a hospital or some entity to determine who is in fact underinsured. And finally, but not insignificantly, it reduces the incentive to have private insurance for hospital care. I mean, why should my health plan cover hospital care if I can pay less than cost for it through this bill?
Madam
so what
Chair,
can
Senator Gordley, I'm sorry to interrupt, but Mr. Earls, do you have your written testimony available
yes.
to the committee?
Yes,
now?
I would be happy to provide it.
Do you have copies?
And I have one more comment, and then I'm conclude with my written comments.
You do not have copies available now?
Yes.
That's what I'm asking.
I'd be happy to provide
Thank you.
So what can the legislature do instead? Well, we can restore the state level general fund commitment to Medicaid to its 2003 level, which we haven't done after 4 years. We can commit to restoring health care access to the 60,000 people in the OHP standard program, which have been eliminated. And we can commit to funding Oregon's general fund percentage spent on Medicaid to a level that at least meets the national average. We were once 20% above the national average in the commitment of general fund to Medicaid. We're now well below the national average. So, in conclusion, in Brazil, the solution seemed obvious. Simply raise the cost of tickets to paying customers. And if Senate Bill 988 were enacted in its current form, Oregonians and our elected officials will be faced with the same dilemma. Increasing the cost to remaining citizens will reduce ridership, the participation in private insurance that is essential to the stability of our health care system. Thank you.
Let's hear all the testimony, and then we'll have questions.
Madam Chair and Committee, good morning. My name is Rick Kagan, and I'm the Chief Administrative and Strategic Officer for the Providence Health System in Oregon. And to my left, your right, Priscilla Lewis, who is the Regional Director of our Community Development Program. Just a few things to add to Mr. Earle's testimony. We, like you, Madam Chair and others, are concerned about the service and the cost of health care to the uninsured and the underinsured, particularly the uninsured and the underinsured that cannot pay, afford to pay, and I'll describe in a minute. There are many uninsured and underinsured that do have the ability to pay. For 150 years, the Providence Health System has provided care to the poor and vulnerable. That's what we do. Last year, we provided a little over $55 million to those who couldn't pay. We provided their care. In the past couple of years, we've been evaluating our financial assistance program. If you have questions regarding it, that Priscilla is here to help me address those questions. But we've significantly evaluated how we provide financial assistance to those who are uninsured as well as underinsured. And today, this very day, we will provide care and financial assistance to about 200 of our patients in Providence. We do it about 200 times a day. Patients at Providence are provided financial assistance because they are either uninsured or underinsured. The concept of a payment structure for the uninsured and the underinsured is good. But the Medicare reimbursement rate is not the way to go from my standpoint. There are four or five reasons. Mr. Earle's articulated a number of those, but let me just be a little bit more specific from a delivery system standpoint. The Medicare system in Oregon, the Medicare reimbursement, is one of the lowest in the country. Mr. Earle's suggested that Medicare pays below cost. And it would exacerbate the cost shift, which it will. But if we were in Dade County, which is the highest reimbursed Medicare reimbursed county in the country, I would be delighted to have any one of my patients, any one of our patients reimbursed at that level, because they are reimbursed so much better than we are in the state of Oregon. Matter of fact, we are top quarter percentile of those states reimbursed poorly. There are only a few that are reimbursed worse than we. Secondly, as mentioned, healthcare providers are facing a growing challenge of the uninsured and the underinsured by people who actually can afford insurance but just choose not to. They choose not to because their deductibles may be too high, their copays may be too high, so they choose not to, but they can afford to pay. The challenge is to provide them care at Medicare rates, as Mr. Earls mentioned, which is below cost, is causing a cost shift and a significant issue for those that do pay, and that is the commercial payer, which are hundreds of thousands of residents of Oregon, Oregonians. The third reason that we don't favor Medicare limits, payment limits, is, again, as Mr. Earle says, our obligation to serve the needy. If we are asked to accept payment at Medicare rates for the uninsured and the underinsured that can pay, those that cannot pay are going to suffer financially. We won't be able to provide that care to the neediest of the population of the state of Oregon. And finally, and fourth on the list, but probably not fourth in importance, is the Medicare system is a very complex and convoluted system. The way that Medicare is paid, the Medicare system was created in 1965, over 40 years ago, and it has not been changed significantly since. In 1974, it was changed to the DRG system, which is the only change that the Medicare system has seen in 40 years. Those of you on the committee, Madam Chair, and others in the room, are talking about, with the healthcare delivery systems, including Providence, are talking about healthcare reform. One of the major components of healthcare reform over a long, protracted period of time is the Medicare system. It's not a system, I think, in my opinion, that we want to duplicate at the private level as a limit of payment for the uninsured and the underinsured. Again, caring for the poor and vulnerable is what we do, and as those who are underinsured and uninsured that cannot pay, when they come to our doors, we serve them. We ask for financial statements so that we can process the financial needs, our financial needs policy with them, and provide care and absorb the payment. But a limit on the Medicare, a limit to Medicare payment levels would be inappropriate, in our opinion, for those patients. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I don't have testimony.
Okay. We have to learn to live with the Medicare reimbursement rate. I mean, there's no way the federal government, it appears, is going to do anything about it. And I feel it's totally unfair, but we have to adapt to the situation that we're in. And one of these is to get... One of the ways to help solve the problem is to get all Oregonians participating in the health insurance program. I mean, to have every person participating. That's one thing. But I just want to comment on the culture that we live in now. I remember when my family physician, and this is back in the 50s, and where specialty care really wasn't honed in like it is now. But now we are so money oriented, and we don't have physicians we have physicians, and there's one seated in the front row here, who want to be family physicians doing health care rather than choosing a specialty that's going to make a lot of money, and no, I don't want to really deal with the Medicaid or the lower income. And I know you can't necessarily have an answer to that, but I just have this gnawing chagrin that our culture is so focused on making money, and we truly, the disparity between the rich and the poor is getting bigger and bigger, and to me, this bill sort of symbolizes the problem that we're in the disparity that is occurring right now between the haves and the have-nots. And so it basically comes down to money, and we're short of money. But do you have any comments whatsoever on that before we get the proponent up here?
Madam Chair, thank you. I would, and committee, I would love to respond. A very quick story, if I might. Over 50 years ago, a little over 50, when I was born, the percentage of the gross national product attributable to healthcare was 4%. 25 years later, when my son David was born, the percentage had doubled to 8%. 25 years later, when my granddaughter was born, it had doubled again to 16%. It is untenable. There is no question about it. It is unaffordable and unaccessible to many. Universal access, as we've talked with Senator Bates and Westland and others, is an extremely necessary and appropriate move over the next number of years. This, however, this piece of legislation, in my opinion, exacerbates the problem of the cost shift rather than gets us moving in the right direction. What I'm afraid, talking about family physicians, and we've got one in the front row, he can address it better than I. I'm worried that as reimbursement drops for certain populations of patients, physicians will start refusing to see those patients. We now have about 60% of the family physicians, the primary care doctors in Portland, refusing to see Medicare patients because payment is so low. If we then infuse more Medicare payment-paying patients into that system, you're going to have physicians refusing to see even more. And those then, those patients, as you know, Madam Chair, being in your business, as you know, they come into the emergency department, and we still see them at an inflated rate, an unnecessarily inflated rate. Thank you very much.
And true, I think you can say payment is an excuse for a certain number of physicians who don't see, and dentists who do not see Medicaid patients. But usually these patients, because they don't have adequate access and health care, are sicker. Their health problems are more complicated, and I feel that might be the overriding cause of why physicians don't want to see the Medicaid population, because they're far more complicated and are actually going to take a whole lot more resources and medical care. So to me, we need to fix the problem in making sure everyone has access and gets adequate health care. And then maybe we wouldn't have this problem. But anyway, I'm on my soapbox. Is there any other? Yes, Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. I'm wearing glasses, but they're not helping me to read the data on that chart. So can you tell me how many people in Oregon, can afford insurance but choose not to get insured? What data supports that statement, which you've made, the panelists made several times?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Gordley, the data that I have before you is from the Office of Health Policy and Research. And I don't think I'm able to answer your question directly, because I think it requires a value judgment of at what point is a person's income put them at a level where they have an obligation to themselves, their family, and their community to cover themselves. But what the data shows, this is 2004 data, and if you look at line 21, I've highlighted three rows. 300 to 400% of the federal poverty level for a family of four would be incomes up to $75,000. This is in 2004, so those numbers would grow. In 400 to, and there's about 50,000 people in that category. The next category is 400 to 500% of the federal poverty level, incomes up to about 94,000. 44,000 people in that category. Above 500% of the federal poverty level, thank you, Senator Carter. For families with incomes over 94,000, 38,000 roughly. These are, again, 2004 numbers before we saw a significant increase in the uninsurance rate in the state. So these numbers, I think you could say, are understated. So we've got roughly 130,000 people there, or perhaps 20 to 25% of the total, with incomes that, from my perspective, probably meet that threshold. That's my value judgment. The other, I think, way, the other perspective that I felt would be important for the committee to see is, as what's happened to the charity care and uncompensated care demand for Oregon hospitals, as we've experienced the things that I referenced in my testimony, the loss of 60,000 people out of OHP standard, an increase in the uninsurance rate as a result of the declining economy. And if you just look at most recent years, I mean, we were at 218 million in uncompensated care for Oregon hospitals in 2001. It rose to 400,000 2 years later, 400 million 2 years later, so a significant increase. But it's gone up by 350 million in the last 3 years. So again, to Rick's point, these kind of growth trends are unsustainable. And these are directly the result of the kind of lack of funding, the lack of state funding to Medicaid, which we end up picking up when the state withdraws funding. And it should be noted, although I know the committee is aware of this, that this financial assistance is provided without the benefit of the federal Medicaid match. So simply addressing this problem, which is real, by saying hospitals should provide bigger discounts or more free care exacerbates the problem, which threatens the rest of the insurance market. So from my perspective, we have done a lot in this state by putting financial assistance programs in place. Those are more, in many cases, much more beneficial to consumers than what is offered in the bill. If we need to focus within our industry, it's perhaps making sure that more people are aware of those policies, that Oregonians that are served by hospitals that have true financial need, that aren't in the categories with 500% of the federal poverty level incomes, are getting care in the existing programs. We've done a lot here to try and enhance the availability of that knowledge. We can do more, but we're only one part of the equation. The legislature has ultimately to respond to the loss of funding that has been cut, restore that so it can stabilize the market for commercial insureds.
Any other? Yes. For the record, just identify yourself.
I'm Priscilla Lewis. I'm with Providence Health System, Madam Chair, and Senator Gordley. I want to speak to the issue of the have-nots for just a moment. That's sort of my whole job at Providence Health System, is figuring out how to spread resources to the have-nots. And I wanted to provide some frame of reference for the services that we do provide under our financial assistance program. And our financial assistance program is not unique among other hospitals in the state, although we have worked very hard on it. Patients coming to us who are uninsured at 200% or less of federal poverty level receive full uncompensated care once they have met with a financial counselor. And so 200% or less of federal poverty level uninsured patients are already eligible, and for the most part, the majority of them receive financial counseling and receive full discount of their services. And those are truly the neediest in Oregon. And as Mr. Kagan spoke to that fact, we provide this service to 200 patients a day, every day. In terms of uninsured discount, we've had an uninsured discount in place since 2004 for all uninsured patients. And we have no plans to discontinue that discount. So conceptually, this is something that we have recognized as something the neediest Oregonians needed our assistance in place. So I'm just pointing that out, that We believe in responding to the needs of the neediest Oregonians, and we feel that we have expertise and a commitment to doing that. But we believe that this bill actually creates a set of issues that go well beyond just serving the neediest, and unintended consequences that actually, in the end, will reduce the resources that we can provide to those patients.
Thank you. With that, I'd like to now have the proponents, since we have the opponents first, but we, now we have the proponent, Senator Dr. Alan Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members. First, I want to thank you for hearing this bill. Frankly, it was a little bit of a surprise, but I appreciate it. What you just heard is excellent testimony from people I work with every day and who are my friends and who I look forward to working with in the future. And what I think you've really heard here is a crying need, a crying need for reform our healthcare system, which we all are very aware of and know it needs to happen. Sometimes you have something happen in your personal life that slaps you in the head and kind of wakes you up to a problem you've been hearing about for some time and makes it much more real than it had been in the past. I've heard from my patients for years the difficulty in our community of often entering the hospital uninsured and having a huge hospital bill, which they then have to either go to the bankruptcy to pay or try to access programs that are available at the local hospitals, and they have a great difficulty doing that. The problem with the programs we have out there right now is for many people they are not transparent or understandable, and they have a difficulty as individuals entering into those programs. They're different from system to system. Providence has an excellent one, but other systems have ones that are more difficult to access. What you really are hearing about is cost shift. We have three levels of pay basically in the state. We have Medicaid, which is extremely low pay, not nearly close to what the cost of that program are as far as providers, especially hospitals, are concerned. Then we have Medicare, which is just below or slightly below what the cost of those programs are as far as hospitals are concerned. Then we have commercial pay, which takes on the cost shift for those two areas. Generally speaking, in broad terms, commercial pays about 70% of the estimated cost and bill you get, and it's discounted by the hospitals against what they're being charged through negotiations with commercial carriers. Medicare and Medicaid are well below that 70%. When an individual goes into the hospital, however, and gets a bill back from the hospital, they don't get the 70% discount or the Medicare rate or the Medicaid rate. In fact, you can't usually find what those are because there's no transparency. It's very difficult to figure out. I recently had an issue in my family where a member of my family went to a local hospital, was put in, and supposedly I know how the system works. So when the bill came back out, I called the hospital up and said, I'm going to take care of this bill. It's a relative. I believe in taking care of, you know, of your family. It's not a direct relative, but most of them I'm close to. I'll take care of this bill. It was a substantial bill. I said, you know, I like to pay the commercial rate.
Okay.
No, we won't let you have that. We want the full payment up front right now. If you pay cash right now for the $20,000, we'll allow you a 15% discount. Now, it took me about 15 phone calls to get that far into the system. At that point, I realized that I was going to have to pay everything with a 15% discount. If I have that much problem entering the system, what's it like for others that haven't got my knowledge, that don't know the board of directors, don't know the CEO? I've not been a member of the staff for 30 years. It became very real to me that the systems you're hearing about, which I think can work much better if they are simpler and more straightforward and more transparent, need to be fixed. And that's what this bill is really about. I got some attention with a slap on the head. I'm trying to get some attention with this bill. Because what we're talking about here is a cost shift. We've been cost shifting to commercial carriers forever. But we're talking about a continued cost shift to the people we should not be cost shifting to, people who are uninsured. We're cost shifting to the people in Oregon who can least afford the cost shift right now. We need to stop that policy. Until such time as we really obtain true change in our healthcare system, true universal access, true sharing of cost, we need something of this nature to protect those Oregonians, not the ones that are at $75,000 a year, but that 400,000 or 500,000 Oregonians who are underinsured or uninsured, who are at 200% 250% of the poverty level and have a huge hospital bill. And it's not because they chose not to buy health insurance. They couldn't afford that health insurance. Their employers couldn't afford that health insurance. And they've been hospitalized, usually for very good reasons, with a bill they can't afford. Leading cause of bankruptcy in America, health costs. We need to protect those people in Oregon. I think we're vulnerable in this population, and I think this bill speaks to it. In conclusion, I would ask that, number one, we not move the bill. I'd like to have a chance to down and talk to the hospitals about this. I think we've got somebody's attention here today, got my attention today. And with due respect to the hospitals and to this committee, I would like to sit down and form a work group and deal with this issue and bring it back to you.
Thank you. Question? Yes, Senator Courtney.
Thank you, Chair Munson. Did you say the leading care cause of bankruptcy is health care costs?
Health care costs are the leading cause of bankruptcy in America right now.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Thank you. I'm glad that you brought this to our attention. Truly, we need health care reform. This could make the situation worse, or if it does help, it would just be a Band-Aid. We truly need to look at getting everyone covered, and we truly need to have a significant health care reform. And there are a number of us on this panel that agree with that, so thank you. Any other discussion?
Yes. I thank Senator Bates for bringing this to our attention. But more than that, I said to some other health care people before, including insurance companies, all of us are in this together. And I appreciate so much your speaking to the issue of a work group, because it is true what Mr. Earle said in terms of how hospitals came to the plate in 2003 and 2005. Now, Mr. Earle, I have to tell you, you did benefit from it. So I want to remind the hospitals that you did benefit from it. But we all benefited from it. So we don't want to forget that little caveat either. But I don't want anybody pushed in the corner that they feel that a Big Mac truck is running over them, because all of us are in this together. And how we work it out is going to be very important, that people are left feeling as if they're making a contribution, like Providence Hospital, that says, we already have a plan in place to take care of those people at the FPL of 200%. So I appreciate very, very much your attitude of wanting to work together and go forward with all of us as Oregonians at the table. And don't forget to bring the pharmaceuticals with you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Carter.
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Carter, I couldn't agree more with your statement, and I would like to work with all parties in this.
Yes.
But we do need to protect this part of our population better.
And I think this may be even an interim issue also, but I think we need to be focusing on the health care reform. So what I will not assign the task force, but I will put this in your ballpark and work. And if you feel that there's something that we'll be able to get off of the floor of the Senate, we can come back and readdress this bill.
Thank you.
I'd be willing to help.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 988, and I'd like to open a public hearing on SJM 13. And Jim Gardner, Senator Morissette, and Jim Edge.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. Thank you. Senate Joint Memorial 13 was at the suggestion of my good friend Jim Gardner. And we are talking about this in our Ways and Means Subcommittee. In fact, we will be getting to it today. And part of the problem in the reauthorization of CHIP is that there is possibly a large payback by the state of Oregon into the general fund to fund CHIP in other states. There is a reauthorization, and there are things that we have to be very careful of, and the purpose of this is to urge Congress and the President to do the reauthorization and to make sure that we don't have a big shortfall in terms of payback. With that, I will turn it over to Jim Gardner. And Jim Edge is with us today if you have any extensive questions about the CHIP program.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for PhRMA, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. One of the proactive efforts nationally that PhRMA is engaged in is to urge Congress as strongly as possible to renew the sunset, extend the sunset on the CHIP program, which does need to be reauthorized by September 1, 2007. And part of that effort is to seek the passage of resolutions such as SJM 13 in as many as possible of the 50 states so that the states have made their voices heard in terms of underscoring the importance of this program for the goal of extended health care coverage for kids. And our written testimony is in support of that.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Edge. I'm the interim administrator of the Division of Medical Assistance Programs in the Department of Human Services. And thank you for addressing this issue of the Children's Health Insurance Program reauthorization at the federal level. I could give you just a few bits of information about the CHIP program and how Oregon uses the CHIP program if you would like. We currently have 38,000 children approximately in Oregon's CHIP program. The CHIP program is an optional Medicaid program. Oregon began to take advantage of it when it was made available in 1997. One of the big advantages of the CHIP program for Oregon is it has a very high federal match rate. Currently about 71% of the costs are paid for by the federal government. The governor's recommended budget for 07-09 projects that this program will continue to grow. It is a growing program and projects that about 48,000 children per month will be in that program as an average monthly caseload for that program in 07-09. Oregon's annual federal allotment for this program is $57 million. And one of the unique features of this program in the past has been that carryover is allowed. Oregon has not expended $57 million per year, and we are currently allowed to carry over money. We are currently projecting carrying over $62 million to the next biennium. The proposal that is before Congress right now by the administration would make some changes in the CHIP program, would make a small decrease in the program, a 4% decrease nationally, national expenditures. The big change that would affect Oregon is that it would no longer allow carryover, so Oregon stands to potentially lose its $62 million potential carryover. That's the major thing that is of concern to us. We're concerned that the program be reauthorized. We're also concerned that Oregon be protected from that proposal, that there be no allowance for carryover. And in fact, our congressional delegation, Senator Smith and Senator Wyden, are aware of that and are working to try to protect Oregon from that. With that, if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Would you want to propose an amendment that addresses that issue in this memorial?
I think that would be a good idea.
I think if we're losing $62 million.
Because that's the big issue for Oregon, is that payback that would take the money away from us and, you know, prevent the carryover. And that's a huge issue if we lose $62 million.
Because if we could get that amendment real quick, because I had planned to move it today, but then when I read it, it's really just saying to reauthorize. But I think
we should have a statement in there that we're actually losing $62 million if we're not able to carry over.
Madam Chair, I'd be delighted to work with Shannon and LC if you'd like to prepare that.
Okay. Thank you. Will do. All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Joint Memorial 13 and committee. We will be meeting at 8:30 next week, but then 7:15 on next Wednesday, and I wanted Senator Cruz to hear that too, that a week from today, I feel we're going to have a lot of carryover on mental health bills, and so we'll be meeting at 7:15 on a week from Wednesday, but 8:30 on Monday.
And why are
you
starting so late?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Courtney.
Please, so you won't get mad at me. I'm on legislative reform. I was going to move them to 7 o'clock in the morning. That isn't going to do them any good now. So just so you know, I got this two thing going on.
Well, we were trying to get evenings, and that's not happening. And so I realized that had a conflict. But we have a lot of public hearing to do, and we'll just wait until you're able to come before we pass anything out.
7:15 next Wednesday.
Next Wednesday. All right. Did I close the public hearing? Yes, I did. Okay, with that, we're adjourned. I do have a